Welcome to the NPM podcast. Joining me today is Alan Marks of Milbank, a member of the firm's Global Project Energy and Infrastructure Finance Group, to discuss some of the latest trends in capital markets for clean energy. Welcome to the program today, Alan.
Hi, John. Thanks very much for having me.
Glad you're here. You can actually hear Alan speak, or actually moderate a panel on April 9th at our fourth annual U.S. Development and Finance Forum at the Four Seasons in Houston. But first, we get to hear his thoughts on a couple of key topics going on in the world. So, Alan, let's just start off with inflation, taking a broader view. Where do you expect that it's hitting the hardest from a renewable energy developer today?
I think, you know, if you look at it, at inflation, a lot of people focus on the volatility that we see in the monthly numbers that are reported and in the headline CPI, consumer inflation. But I think if you look at development for projects, the thing to remember is to look at a multi-quarter and certainly maybe even a multi-year trend, because that's what really impacts investment decisions. The other thing is you can't just focus on consumer prices. You've got to look at producer prices, manufacturing, and maybe even dig down into those to see how it is affecting the real costs, both manufactured components and labor to develop and construct a project. And then on top of that, the cost of capital, which of course is independent from inflation for goods and services. So the CPI numbers lately have gone up. They're still stubborn. They went down quite a bit last year. We're down, over 3%, but we were over 9% a year ago. So yay, that's great. But if you look at producer numbers and manufactured goods, the success story is actually pretty good. I mean, we're seeing much lower rates of inflation than we were a year ago, significantly lower producer prices than consumer prices as far as increases. And supply chains are, I think, a real reason for that, because although we still have very robust demand for manufactured goods, the supply constraints and the logistics constraints that we saw a year and 2 years ago have largely been smoothed out. Now, of course, there's still some bottlenecks in the system. I think if you're an offshore wind developer, you're looking at some different things than if you're building a transmission line or a solar power plant. But we're seeing oversupply and overcapacity in Chinese semiconductor manufacturing, in steel and copper. Around the world, we've seen some bumps in metals prices in the last month, of course. But overall, I would say we're seeing more stability in prices, and that makes it easier to plan. So if you're trying to predict what the cost will be for your pipeline of projects, there's a little more certainty than I think there has been at any time in the last 3 years, and that's a good thing, because that means those prices can be baked in, and there's less need to have excess liquidity available in cases of volatility in the short term for a lot of those prices and those price inputs for projects. So on the whole, I think that's one reason we're seeing a continued very, very strong investment pipeline in renewables.
Does it correlate when developers are choosing to sell their projects today, or as a better capitalized independent power producer to rationalize their portfolio? Or do you think that's just kind of rooted in other factors?
I think if you're trying to sell an operating portfolio of projects, the valuations of those are based on the discounted cash flows for the most part. They may also be based on replacement cost. And on both of those, I think the cost of capital is probably the biggest variable. So there we're really looking at interest rates more than inflation, and also how people are going to build their capital stack for that. So they'll have cash equity, they'll have debt, potentially maybe back levered debt, or portfolio level debt. The interest rates seem to be stable and are predicted to fall later in the year, so that will help those valuations quite a bit. And then tax equity remains available, and the new abilities under the Inflation Reduction Act to monetize tax credits in other ways remain attractive for a lot of developers. So I think the pipelines that are coming will be based on other things too, like inflation and the cost to build those projects. But for operating portfolios, we're seeing a lot of price stability and actually potential valuation increases too.
Great. Shifting gears to platform deal flow. Some overhang got resolved on March 19th with the news that Masdar was taking a 50% stake in utility scale developer TerraGen Power. The platform had been on the market at some point in 2022, probably later in the year. But regardless of that, what's your thoughts on platform M&A this year? What shape it might take, and I've heard some chatter from the market that maybe the second half of the year you'll see more platforms trade, but curious your thoughts on this.
So we often see more activity in the second half of the year across the board, right? Not just in M&A, but also in tax equity and
Fair enough.
financings for mega projects and the like. What I take, not just looking at the Masdar Terragen deal, but looking more broadly at other platform deals too, I would predict we will see over the course of the next 18 months continued interest from non-US buyers, continued interest from both buyers and sellers on the private equity or infrastructure fund side, as incumbent owners are looking to realize gains and maybe close out funds. And there's still a lot of, dry powder left to be deployed. So, we're already seeing lots of activity with people either kicking the tires or getting closer to closing deals on these platforms. One of the things that, is interesting about all of the investment we've seen in renewables in the last few years and the significant capacity additions we saw for wind and solar just last year is there's a lot more that could be for sale, right? There's a lot more need to recycle funds if you're a developer, and a lot more interest, I think, than in buying these operating projects. For people buying platforms that are also looking for a development platform, that are looking for a pipeline of new projects, I think the key variable there will be location first. Where are those projects to be developed? And what are some of the constraints on the development of that pipeline? We can talk about that, if you like, in a moment in more detail. But I think that's very location specific, and to some extent also technology specific, as between solar, onshore wind, and offshore wind. And then you're also looking at the skill and the strength of those development teams. Not all development teams are the same. Some have more skills than others. Some are therefore more valuable to potential buyers that are looking to deploy capital, not just to buy operating projects, but are looking for a platform where they can have a pipeline that they can develop to expand for growth and for synergies. And that scalable growth, I think, is a real attraction of a lot of the platforms. But again, they're not all the same. And some of those deals, there may be people who pay overpay, and there may be others where they really get a great bargain because there's some good development teams out there that could, help to scale that growth.
I think I will move on to that topic, Alan. We're kind of observing like two main areas of obstacles, I think, today. Number one, interconnection queues and where some of these projects stack up in these processes. And then once past the interconnect, or even before it, depending on where things are, the city or county you're located in, and where the opposition might lie, and sort of the probability of getting through like key permits. I'm just kind of wondering, if a lot of this has come up in discussion, on project M&A, or is or are there other more pertinent topics that come up when, and this is obviously for projects versus operating, but just curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so for projects that are in the pipeline, either early stage development, late stage development, maybe even construction for some of them, that's a significant part of the value that's driving M&A transactions. It's also, of course, an even bigger driver for deployment of the debt and equity that are coming in, to develop and build projects. And interconnection queues, and permitting generally, to me, are the single, collectively the single biggest bottleneck to expanding investment beyond where it already is. So kind of, back up for a second. I think the Inflation Reduction Act provided a huge boost on top of an already strong market to deploy capital to renewable energy in particular and decarbonization in general. And a lot of funds have been directed, accordingly, and will continue to be so long as those tax incentives remain in place. The bottlenecks to bringing all that capacity on are, well, you got to plug it in somewhere. Transmission grids need to be upgraded. Regulators and the operators of the regional transmission organizations, RTOs, need to study the impacts on the grid, not just of all of this new power, but of also shifting power demand, with digital infrastructure and EV charging networks and so forth, also kind of increasing the demand for electricity and changing some of the locational aspects of that. There's right now over 2,000 gigawatts of proposed renewable power projects. I should say projects overall, but vast majority, say 95%, are renewables that are sitting in various stages of impact studies for grid connectivity. So that's a lot. I mean, put that in context. We added a little over 30 gigawatts of new renewable capacity in the United States last year. So it's, a significant portion of that over the next 8 to 10 years that is predicted to come online, or at least where developers are hoping they will. A lot of that is clustered in various different places. The bulk of it is solar, standalone storage, or solar plus storage. Another good chunk is wind. Relatively little is natural gas, or other things. A lot of that's in California. About a quarter of the national total by gigawatts is in California. Texas, New York, Illinois, Arizona, are other states where there's large concentrations of projects that are, in the interconnection queue. And even when they're approved, you mentioned local permits. You still have the issues of getting local permits, not just for the projects themselves, but for the interconnection system upgrades and other things. And with energy storage, that raises specific issues as well with respect to local permitting. Lastly, you did not mention it, but I would also add, for all of this capacity to be efficiently used, especially utility scale new capacity, we need significant transmission system upgrades. And, we will see investment in that. There was significant push for it in not so much in the Inflation Reduction Act, although there are some monies for that, but especially in the bipartisan infrastructure bill that was passed a couple years earlier. So we'll continue to see transmission upgrades, but those are also going to face challenges as far as permitting, siting, right-of-way access. And there we have a large role for states and local governments. A lot of people can say no, very few people can say yes, and that's how our system's designed. But I think that's the single biggest bottleneck for projects. So if I'm looking to develop one, or I'm looking to invest in one, or to buy a pipeline or a platform of potential projects that are under development, I think the first thing to look at is where are they located? What are the physical constraints that could lead to congestion or curtailment in the transmission system? What are the changes in either regulatory design, market design at the state level? What are the RTOs doing to bring that online? How long will it take to get an interconnection agreement? And once I'm up and running, how reliable will it be for me to get my power physically to market? And what kind of impacts will I face from volatility and nodal pricing or other things that are location specific? And then how is that allocated if I have offtake contracts and who's bearing those risks? I think all of those things are critically important if you're really getting granular on which projects or which project pipelines are going to be successful.
Great. Well, shifting to another type of developer who's been coming on as of late has been utilities. If you don't want to do PPAs, you can just build solar on your own, which has come up now more than not on some of these RFP processes. The concept of the self-build has come up quite a bit in some of the latest round of RFPs launched this year, launched last year. It comes against sort of this juxtaposition where, a couple of the larger utilities, of course, in the last few years have sold their renewable development arms, their unregulated renewable development arms, such as Con Edison and American Electric Power, to name a few. I kind of wanted to get your take on this on a few areas. Number one, to your point, modernizing outdated transmission lines, which utilities are on the hook for, and then at the same point, raising the capital needed to develop solar and storage and wind on their own, which, again, we've shown has become an expensive proposition. I mean, it may have been the supply chain at some point, but it's also now the size of these projects, the scope of these projects. So just trying to get your view on some of these issues.
Yeah, it's a good question. Many years ago, I mean, more than 20 years ago, I used to do some utility financing. And I think if you're a utility looking to build out your system, the first thing you've got is if you've got demand growth, where are you going to get additional generating resources to meet that demand? And one of the promises of the demonopolization of energy generation coming out of PURPA in the late 70s and all through the 80s was that we would have a more efficient, maybe more reliable, certainly cheaper and cleaner energy grid if utilities were not the only ones building their own power plants. And that's why we have the very large market today for independent developers and independent owners and operators of power plants that sell their power to utilities or to others directly in states where that's allowed. So how do utilities make money? Well, they issue debt, they use that to and sell equity, they use that money to buy their own assets or to build them or to procure power at wholesale, and they upgrade their systems and they sell it to consumers and they get a regulated reasonable return through their rate cases on that allows them to pass through costs plus a reasonable margin to their retail rate base. And there's different rates for commercial versus industrial or residential customers, depending on where you are. And regulators have different, preferences. But by and large, if you're a utility, it's a fairly boring business in one sense, but it's also a very complicated, interesting one on the other, because you're trying to manage that within some pretty tight guardrails for affordability, reliability, and reasonable return. Now, if I'm a utility today and I'm in an area where the regulator will allow me to build and own my own generating capacity versus buying it at wholesale, and I may do both, then the question is am I better off being asset heavy or asset light? We're starting to even to see some of the very asset light, as in no assets, community choice aggregators looking at maybe buying some of their own or owning some of their own facilities, either for energy storage or where they're allowed for energy generation. We're seeing very large utilities that are looking at whether they want to shift and focus more on investments on transmission, especially long distance transmission upgrades, and what their generation mix is going to be. With decarbonization, we are in a place where the generation mix is changing rapidly in many parts of the country. And the utilities, I think, bring a real advantage when they can do their own vertically integrated planning to look at long-term demand shifts as well as changing generation and transmission and distribution needs. But there's a cost to that. I live in Los Angeles, and LADWP just announced a rate hike, which we'll face. And it's not because of the commodity charge of energy, because they need more money to maintain and upgrade their existing transmission and distribution assets in order to maintain reliability of the system. And obviously, spreading those costs over all ratepayers, over the whole rate base, makes that more affordable for everybody. And it's a good way to do it. I think the question of whether utilities should be developing their own or buying their own solar or wind farms or what have you, kind of depends a lot on the regulatory context in which they're situated, and it depends on their cost of capital. And that kind of brings us back full circle to where we were on interest rates before, because utilities have, generally speaking, a very low cost of capital relative to other companies, partly because of the stability of their cash flows and partly because of the regulatory oversight that they're subject to. So in an era rather, where you have, rising or high interest rates like we've seen for the last 18 months, that makes it much harder for smaller developers, for debt-heavy developers to compete on a cost of capital basis with utilities. So at this point, it might look like a great idea for utilities to have their own, say, solar power plants, as opposed to buying the power at wholesale and locking in some of these rates that reflect the real cost that developers face. By the same token, access to tax credits, utilities can do that for transmission, but for generation, I think how one structures tax credit monetization, how you have scale or regional diversity across large areas, for some of the larger developers, they actually may have some advantages in those areas. Again, depending on the scale and scope of the utility holding company. And as interest rates come back down, that cost of capital advantage is going to, be mitigated quite a bit. And the decision one might think makes sense today might not actually make that much sense in 2025.
Great. Thanks for that. The next question
Oh,
we
by the way, John, if I may, I mean, one of the real tests of that, there's a market test to it. When utilities put out RFPs to acquire new generation capacity or new power sources, and they compare that to their own internal costs, I mean, it's pretty easy to see for them, I think, in real time, it's pretty easy for them to see in real time, you know, where the markets are moving and which one will provide the best, you know, bang for the buck for their ratepayers.
Right, got it. Okay, well, shifting gears to tax equity, and you know, this is a topic we could have a separate 3 hour lecture if we wanted to. Actually, it could be more than that at this point. It's because of what the IRA unlocked, you know, and just in terms of the sheer volume and variety of deals that we've seen so far. Developers locking in tax equity and on the transfer for their projects, and then developers with an operating portfolio just being you know, saying, oh, we can do this too, and monetizing tax credits off operational assets, you know, sort of lending to the some of these pre-IRA theories about there being a large corporate audience waiting to participate in this market. But I guess I would lead off with, you know, what your thoughts are on this trend so far. And more importantly, do you think there's going to be a day of reckoning at some point if there, you know, with too many of these transactions? And then also, you know, bigger projects may be soaking up some capacity, you know, offshore wind, you know, we're aware of a couple of deals which will hit the market later this year. You know, on a size wise, probably comparable with what Vineyard Wind got in 2023. So just wanted to get your thoughts around some of these ideas.
It's a good question, and there's a lot there. I guess I would divide it up. Let me take it kind of in backwards and in inverse order to the way you just posed the
Yeah, that's
question.
a, I like that. Yeah, let's do
Sure.
that.
So, like, let's look at, like, well, I call it the cluster effect, right? Where you have lots of really big projects that are going to try to come to market at the same time. Offshore wind certainly is, because of the scale of those projects and their long lead times, it's entirely possible to see multiple very large projects coming in and seeking either debt or tax equity at the same in the same year, maybe even the same quarter. And that can have an effect of soaking up a lot of the available capacity. I think more on the tax equity side perhaps than on the debt side, where the debt markets, you know, of course, are significantly larger with more players and more depth than just the smaller subset of those institutions, especially banks that are providing capital for tax equity monetization transactions, or, you know, to buy tax credits essentially. And I'm working right now on, you know, some very large offshore wind projects. Not all of them will be requiring third-party tax equity, but, you know, there's still, you know, this question that any developer has about, will I be coming to market the same time as everybody else, even if I'm just looking for, you know, construction debt. I think at the moment the market is deep enough that none of those projects are going to cause that as a lasting problem, even though one or two quarters could be, you know, challenging maybe for one or two projects. And I think the Inflation Reduction Act has, you know, created not just a bigger market for developers that are looking to invest in decarbonized energy sources, but I think we're also seeing, you know, a bigger market for tax equity transactions, and that would include transferability of tax credits and other ways to monetize them. So that, you know, will it attract more corporates into the area? I think that depends not so much on anything narrow in what's happening in energy markets, or anything narrow what's happening with, you know, for example, tax credit guidance out of Treasury or transferability markets that it will be developing and are still, you know, at this point pretty nascent. But I think it depends also on the overall economy, and also what happens with, you know, corporate tax rates going forward. If we were to see an increase in corporate tax rates, you know, people talk about between going up to, you know, 21, 25%, you know, that's going to create more of an appetite for a tax shield and maybe a bigger depth of market for potential corporate investors in tax credits. By the same token, if corporate rates stay the same or go down, then there's less of a need for people to shield income, and therefore less market for tax credits. If you look at bank profits, you know, most of the tax credit monetization is going to banks because they have very steady and predictable earnings, and therefore can make the use of those credits that, you know, developers and the people selling them can't. And that's kind of intentional. I mean, Congress wants these credits to be used. Congress wanted, when they passed this law, to, you know, encourage certain types of investment. That's why we do it through the tax code. If you see an economic slowdown, if you see a decline in bank profitability, or if you see a bigger, you know, a recession where large corporates no long where large corporates are no longer trying to shield income, that I think has a bigger negative impact on the appetite and the capacity of the market to absorb tax credits and to monetize them the way we do now.
All very interesting points. So we're gonna end this one with a presidential election that's coming up in about 8 months, just under 8 months. I guess how do you envision the outcome will impact clean energy policy this time around? I mean, I'd say we got blue states and red states all participating in renewable energy at this point. It seems like a very clear bipartisan issue, but I'll let you do the talking.
Thanks for the softball question, John.
This is how we end podcast, Alan, with softball questions. That's correct.
So the outcome of the presidential election in the United States in 2024, how will that impact what energy policy, I guess?
Yes.
Well, I think it's going to have a lot of there's a lot at stake in this election, no question. And we're a very politically polarized country for sure. I think you're right in that renewable energy investment crosses political boundaries. There has historically been a very strong bipartisan support for wind and solar and other renewables. But the market, the environment we're in right now politically is not defined really by policy. It's defined by I think some bigger differences in political philosophies and kind of just sentiments. So I think the presidential election will impact more than just energy policy. And I think renewables are becoming politicized just like everything else is in Washington. It will impact the economy as a whole. It will impact the predictability or not of regulations and the rule of law. I think there's a question as to, what parts of the IRA maybe could be scrapped if you actually had one party controlling the other party controlling all of Congress, both House and Senate and the White House, versus if you have a split chambers in Congress or you have one party controlling Congress and another in the White House. Those are all different. But rolling back the Inflation Reduction Act would require a congressional, statute. That said, guidance from Treasury, how laws are enforced and implemented, funding from other programs, for example, the federal funding of EV networks, everything that the Department of Energy is doing, especially through the Loan Guarantee Program Office, but also through other programs which provide direct assistance for newer clean energy initiatives, hydrogen, nuclear fusion, what have you. I mean, all of that would be, subject to who's in the White House. Trade policy, and to this day, there is a lot in the Inflation Reduction Act, which is designed to create domestic manufacturing, domestic jobs, and those sorts of and trade policy on tariffs, especially to defend U.S. markets from dumping from foreign countries, especially China, in areas where that's been alleged, for example, solar panels and solar modules. There, I don't think there's that much difference, frankly, between historically between what Biden has done in office and what Trump did when he was in office beforehand. But I do think there's, a possibility that that could diverge. And then if you don't have a U.S. market that's viewed as predictable or stable from a regulatory or a statutory perspective, what does that do to foreign investment and what does that do to the U.S. dollar and economic, productivity to begin with? So I think, there's more at stake in this election than just energy policy, and my crystal ball is not clear enough to know exactly what all those ramifications would be. But nor do I think, by the way, that most voters are going to put energy policy top of the list when they go into the voting booth and decide for whom to vote. I think they have other bigger issues, at hand. But there is certainly a lot at stake on this election.
Great. Well, on that note, that is all the time we have. Alan, thanks for taking the time today. So thanks again, Alan, for joining us, and please tune in next time. Burke out.
Thanks a lot, John. It was a pleasure.